Give this a test, friends, to see if we are, if you can hear me. Hello, my online friends. Do people out there in Facebook land hear me? I want to make sure. Yep? Okay, good. All right, friends, well, we're going to begin. Let's open with a word of prayer. Father, thank you so much for your presence with us, God. Thank you for your word. Thank you for your spirit. Thank you for your promises, God. And I pray that by your spirit you help us to learn tonight. Help me to teach. Give me strength. Help me to learn. Open the eyes of our understanding. Give us hearing ears, God, discerning hearts, and a yielding attitude, a yielding will, that we would do your will, God, in Jesus' name. Amen. All right, we're going to tackle this quiz, and I am, I know Pastor Steve has set me up, so welcome. I am going to be as energetic as I can be. But I have to warn everyone, I'm not feeling well. My intestinal tract is acting up, and it's triggered my immune system. So I took essentially most of last week off. And I'm physically a little weak and kind of in pain, so pray for me. I'm also a little medicated. So what that means is what I'm finding out is I have really bad impulse control suddenly, and my patients, some of the corticosteroids, they affect things, and the wheels are turning a little slower than they do normally. Not that they're turning that quick to begin with, but they're slowing down. So if you need me to repeat something, I'm happy to do it. And I want to say, friends, thanks to everyone out there for praying for me. Please keep praying. If I haven't replied to you personally, it's only because I haven't been able to keep up, honestly. We have such a loving church and such a big church, and I've been inundated with emails and texts and things, and I'm grateful for those, but if I haven't replied, it's only because I haven't been able to keep up. So sorry about that, but let's begin with the quiz. Well, Pastor Nathan loves to talk about A, Michael Heiser, B, the Nephilim, C, his reformed beliefs, or D, the unseen realm. Well, I'm not sure if this is exactly right, because I do talk about the Nephilim. So being here in the flesh, Steve, I'm going to say I talk about all of these things. Now, my reformed beliefs, what does Steve mean by that? I always tell people I'm reformed with a Wesleyan slant. I have a little bit of John Wesley in my reformed nature. Now, Reformation theology just is, the theology that came out of the Reformation. So that's probably what Steve is referring to. So if you put all of these down, you're probably right. Michael Heiser, by the way, is an excellent contemporary Old Testament Bible scholar. He's a good Bible scholar, period, but he is a kind of a scholar, and he's very good at keeping up with latest archaeology, with the latest research, and here's the thing, he's solidly evangelical. Oftentimes in Old Testament theology, you'll see people who just kind of spout out historical critical method, which is a kind of biblical higher criticism that just basically chops the text into parts and maybe not even believe it. I'm not saying that every person who does historical criticism is that way, but I'm just saying it's very commonplace. And here is a guy who can interact with that stuff, but who is solidly evangelical. So there's my plug, Steve, for Michael Heiser. And we'll move on. Hopefully some of you bought his book, The Unseen Realm. So, John Calvin, so Reformed theology is often linked with John Calvin, but it comes out of the Reformation. You could link it to Martin Luther, you could Zwingli, there are a lot of people. It just basically means very broadly that theology that came out of the Reformation. It could be even Arminius, but it's typically, today it's almost used part well, it's used almost entirely to refer to Calvinism. But I actually happen to be a little more Wesleyan, but I hold to the tenets of Reformed theology. So Steve's just doing that to kind of stick the knife in and turn it just a little bit on me. So that's where that's come from. Dividing the land by lot may have involved roulette, and I don't know how Pastor Steve pronounced this, Urim and Tumim. This is the Hebrew way of saying it, but I'm not going to get caught up in that. Urim and Thummim is fine by me. Rock, paper, scissors. I don't know if that is a very biblical way. Eeny, meeny, miny, mo. Well, it's actually the Urim and the Tumim, or the Urim and Thummim. So if you chose B, you got it right. Which words describe Caleb best? A, foolhardy. B, wholehearted devotion. C, old but strong. D, feeble. It's actually B and C. Now, what's interesting about Caleb, the Hebrew word actually means dog, although that may not be what's meant here. And what's interesting, though, some people say, well, dogs are very loyal. So, you know, he does have a kind of devotion. And you'll remember he's one of the two spies that came back. Two of the spies that went out that came back with a good report. He and Joshua both had a good report. And he was old, but he was strong. And he was willing to keep going. So there's something about Joshua and Caleb that they've been set apart as examples of the people of God who live a life of faith. So really like Caleb. Hebron is known for its A, desert-like qualities, B, source of water, C, pyramids, or D, gardens. The answer is source of water. If you got B. Now, by the way, I haven't checked Pastor Steve on any of this. This is his quiz, so take all complaints to him. He got the first one wrong. He left out the Nephilim on me, so we can't trust him. Which of the following is a Jebusite city at Joshua's time? A, Hebron, B, Beth Araba, C, Jerusalem, or D, Bethel? C, Jerusalem. Yeah, yes, Jerusalem. Six, Caleb's daughter Aksa marries Othniel. We also know Othniel as A, a coward, B, future judge of Israel, C, son of Kenaz, or D, an Ethiopian. Well, it looks like B and C are the correct answers. So if you got those, pat yourself on the back. Don't just pat it too much, though. You know, there's an old saying that, hey, some people walk around with broken arms from patting themselves on the back too much. Dislocated shoulders. But it's good. I hope if you did well on that. That wasn't an easy one. Seven, the Septuagint contains a verse mentioning A, a 12th district for the tribes, B, another conquest of Joshua, C, a different name for Othniel, or D, the mention of Bethlehem. Well, if you have A and D, you are correct. Number eight, who ultimately conquers the Jebusites? A, David, B, Solomon, C, Saul, or D, Gideon? It's David, David. Yeah. Yep. And nine, the book of Jashar is A, in the Old Testament, B, probably a book of epic poems, C, referred to twice in our Bibles, D, includes a poem of David. Well, if you did B, C, and D, you are exactly right. You're exactly right. It's an unusual reference. Number 10, before fighting the kings of the north, the Lord instructed Joshua after victory to A, hamstring their horses, B, burn their chariots, C, circumcise the males, or D, pierce the ears. Their ears. It's A and B. Some trust in horses, other in chariots, but as for us, we'll trust in the name of the Lord our God. You know, this is a classic because oftentimes during this period, I mean, especially if you think go back to Egypt, there were horses and chariots, and these seemed like instruments of power. But for God's people, their power comes from the Lord. And so they're not to put their trust in this. And by the way, later we may hit a verse that does mention things like iron chariots. It probably doesn't mean full-blown iron chariots. It may just mean that it has some iron paraphernalia on it. But that's just a thought that occurred to me. And I may be very stream of consciousness tonight, just because, again, I'm a little on the medicated side. So, all right, so how did we get here? This is a tough, these two chapters are tough to teach. And the reason that it's tough is because we have so many, portions of land, names and land, it's geography and land, and that can be a tough thing to teach on. So to us, it may seem very boring, but I want you to know that to the people of Israel, this would not have been boring. This is a fulfillment of a promise that God gave to Abraham. And it's all the way back in Genesis chapter 12, verses 6 through 7. It says, Abram traveled through the land as far as the site of the great tree of Moreh and at Shechem. At that time, who were in the land? The Canaanites were in the land. Remember, these are the ones being dispossessed. And then verse 7, it says, the Lord appeared to Abram and said, to your offspring I will give this land. So build an altar there to the Lord who has appeared. So he built an altar there to the Lord who appeared to him. Now, what am I trying to get at? This seems mundane or like just rehearsing geography to us. To these people, this is a fulfillment of the promise that God gave to Abraham. And I want you to not underestimate how important this promise is. The promise God gave to Abraham really brought about God's reclaiming the whole earth. Remember, he says to Abraham, all nations will be blessed through your seed. And it's, in some ways, it's talking about collectively, but there's a singular seed the book of Galatians chapter 3 picks up on. That is Jesus, the ultimate seed, the righteous Israelite. Through the seed of Abraham, all nations will be blessed. In fact, they'll be reclaimed. Remember how we talked about the Nephilim and these sons of God, the B'nai Elohim, who had kind of a say over certain portions of land. God kept Israel for himself. And then we said that later on in the book of Acts that you see from Jerusalem moving outward, God is actually reclaiming those nations. He's going to reclaim the whole earth. This is partly due, a large part to do, with God's promise to Abraham. Now, he's tipping them off early on that the Canaanites are in the land. But when you see later on through Moses and now Joshua, just particularly through Joshua because we're in the book, God is taking the land back from these people who have worshipped fallen divine beings, demons, if you will, for lack of a better word. And he's reclaiming the world for himself. So he says, to your offspring, actually to your seed, I will give this land. So this is the promise, and this is why this is such a big deal. So as we go through these boundaries, these borders, these names of places and people, it is going to seem a little boring to us. But to them, this is everything. I mean, it's a big deal. God is keeping his promise. We have a promise-keeping God. So we go back to Joshua chapter 17. Here's where we begin. This was the allotment for the tribe of Manasseh as Joseph's firstborn, that is, for Machir, Manasseh's firstborn. Machir was the ancestor of the Gileadites who had received Gilead and Bashan because the Machirites were great soldiers. Now, do you remember Pastor Steve, I'm assuming last week, I didn't watch his teaching. Oh, yes. I thought I was supposed to do 17 and 18. Okay, well then, this is a conundrum we find ourselves in. I'll tell you what, but I'm prepared to do it, kind of. let's see what we can do here. I am going to open. No, it's okay. We're just going to do it rather than PowerPoint. Joshua 16. 16, yeah. For some reason, I thought Steve texted me 17 and 18 to do. But here, we're going to read through here. Can everyone see this okay? I'm going to blow this up just a bit. See how instant in season I can be? So the allotment for Joseph began at the Jordan, east of the springs of Jericho, and went up from there through the desert into the hill country of Bethel. It went on from Bethel, that is Luz, crossed over to the territory of the Archites to Adaroth, descended westward to the... Oh, my. Okay. descended westward to the territory of the Japhlethites, as far as the region of the lower Beth Horon and onto Gezer, ending to the Mediterranean Sea. So Manasseh and Ephraim, the descendants of Joseph, received their inheritance. This is important. You'll see I'm instant in season. Remember where Joseph was. He was in Egypt, and remember how God used him to rescue his people. You know, the whole story of Joseph, that coat of many colors, if you will. Well, he had two sons in Egypt. He had these two sons, that is Ephraim, and he had Manasseh. And these guys are going to get a big portion of the land. And sometimes they're just referred to as Joseph. His two sons that were born to him in Egypt. And so Manasseh and Ephraim, descendants of Joseph, received their inheritance. They're getting their inheritance up front. This was the territory of Ephraim, according to the clans. The boundary of their territory, their inheritance, went from Adaroth Adar in the east to Upper Beth Horon and continued to the Mediterranean Sea. From Michmethoth on the north, it curved eastward to Taanath Shiloh, passing by it to Yanoa on the east. Then it went down from Yanoa to Adaroth and Na'arah, touched Jericho, came out at the Jordan. From Tapua, the border went west to the Kana Ravine and ended at the Mediterranean Sea. This was the inheritance of the tribe of the Ephraimites, according to its clan. It also included all the towns and their villages and were set aside for the Ephraimites within the inheritance of the Manassites. They did not dislodge the Canaanites living in Gezer. To this day, that phrase is very famous, right? To this day, the Canaanites live among the people of Ephraim, but are not required to do forced labor. So these are people that were not subjugated. And now I'm going to flip back here to the PowerPoint. And so chapter 16, you're seeing this allotment to whom? The sons of Joseph, that is Ephraim and Manasseh. Now this is important. In fact, I'm going to jump back to Genesis 48, not realizing I was skipping chapter 16, but knowing that they were mentioned in chapter 17, I have something for you. Here's something interesting that happened. And Joseph took both of them, that is Ephraim, on his right toward Israel's left. Now, Israel is Jacob's name. Jacob's name, that trickster, has been changed to Israel. So Joseph took both of them, Ephraim on his right toward Israel's left hand, and Manasseh on his left toward Israel's right hand. You can kind of see how he's bringing them to his father, and brought them close to him. What's happening here? Now, Joseph is about to die. And Joseph, usually right at the end, they will pronounce a blessing. But notice what happens that's strange. Verse 17, when Joseph saw his father placing his right hand on Ephraim's head, he was displeased. So he took hold of his father's hand to move it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head. Joseph said to him, "No, my father, this one is the firstborn. Put your right hand on his head." Do you remember how we talked a while back about right hand referring to blessing and wisdom and left hand cursing or foolishness? Now, it sometimes can just refer to the lesser blessing. But something weird is going on here. Notice what Joseph does. But his father, that is Joseph, Israel rather. No, Joseph. I told you the wheels are going to turn slow tonight. Watch me. Please watch me. Refused and said, "I know, my son, I know." he too will become a people, and he too will become great. Nevertheless, his younger brother will be greater than he, and his descendants will become a group of nations. It's a weird thing that's happening. So it's basically Joseph pulls this move where he does this, and the younger one gets the right hand, the greater blessing, and the older one gets the left hand. Now they're both getting blessed, but it's a very weird thing.
But didn't that Joseph, that happened to him because he got above his brothers,
and the
brothers had to
battle. And remember the story of Esau and Jacob?
Yeah.
All that tricky stuff going on. Things don't always come out the way we think they should. The people we think that should get the blessing aren't always the ones that do. And this might be, and this gives us all hope, right, in some ways. Because sometimes it seems like maybe we're not the most talented, or we're not the most educated, or maybe we're not the most gifted, or this. And yet God will use people and individuals like King David. That, all of Jesse's sons show up, and but none of them are anointed king because there is one boy left out herding sheep, a little guy named David, and yet he ends up being anointed. God oftentimes chooses people that will confound the wisdom of man. Left on our own, oftentimes we will choose people that, they're a little taller than everybody. Do you know the average height of a president of the United States is quite tall?
Yes.
Do you know? It's true. We choose people based on height. We choose based on look, the more symmetrical they are. We choose people based on the tone of their voice. We choose people for all kinds of external reasons, but God sees the heart. And only God can discern these things. So, something happens here that the expected order of blessing gets reversed. And then we go back to Joshua chapter 17, verse 2. So this allotment was for the rest of the people of Manasseh, the clans of Abiezer, Helek, Azrael, Shechem, Hepher, and Shemida. These are the other male descendants of Manasseh, son of Joseph, by their clans. Now, one thing to notice is Manasseh follows here, the order, and the order is probably reflecting the position of blessing. So you're getting a kind of taste of the order. Things have been switched around. So if you wondered, why did that happen? Well, you go back to Genesis chapter 48. It will tell you why it happened. So, on to verse 3. Now, Zelophehad... I say that 10 times. Zelophehad, son of Hepher, the son of Gilead, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh, had no sons, but only daughters, whose names were Mahla, Noah, which Noah can be a girl's name, by the way, Hogla, Milcah, and Tirzah. Now, they don't just come tripling off the tongue, do they? The words are not very euphonic. But here's an interesting conundrum. This guy only has females. He has no sons. They went to Eleazar the priest, Joshua son of Nun, and the leaders said, "The Lord commanded Moses to give us an inheritance among our relatives." So Joshua gave them an inheritance along with the brothers of their father according to the Lord's command. Now, if you go back to Numbers chapter 27 and read verses 1 through 11, you'll see how an inheritance can be passed on through a female. You see that there's normally done through males, but it can be done through females. And here's the catch. Normally it was done through males, but there was this point where this came up before Moses. And they said, "Hey, if you don't give us an inheritance, the name of our father will be wiped out." Oh, it's true we only have daughters, but in the Israelite mind, in the Hebrew mind, things should remain with the family. Inheritance should remain with the family. So what happens if you have no sons to leave it to? Well, there's a provision for that. And Moses said this is exactly what should happen so that the name isn't wiped out, that they, you know, that they didn't lose their inheritance. So they basically go and say to Joshua and Eleazar, remember what Moses said. And they listen to what Moses said. They're going to get their inheritance. It's not going to be taken from them. It kind of reminds me of Mary and Martha. You know, Mary chooses the better part, and Jesus says to Martha, it's not going to be taken from her. You know, well, this is exactly what's happening here, or similarly, this is happening. Okay, by analogy, this is happening here. What I'm saying is that God has made a provision for his people to receive an inheritance. And it may not come as you expect. People expected to have sons. It didn't in this case. So there you have it. Yes? Oh, this is interesting. When Queen Elizabeth married Philip, he didn't take her last name, but she didn't take his last name. It was the other way around. He took her last name, which kept the Windsor name going. Yeah. Now, I did not know that. Thank you for sharing that. We've got some people in our audience here that know some things. But this is a great parallel, right? God has made it possible for his people to receive an inheritance, and it's not just because they're male. Just something to keep in mind. So verse 5, Manasseh's share consisted of 10 tracts of land besides Gilead and Bashan east of the Jordan, because the daughters of the tribe of Manasseh received an inheritance among the sons. The land of Gilead belonged to the rest of the descendants of Manasseh. Verse 7, the territory of Manasseh extended from Asher to Michmethoth, east of Shechem. The boundary ran southward from there to include the people living at En-Tapua. Manasseh had the land of Tapua, but Tapua itself on the boundary of Manasseh belonged to the Ephraimites. Now, Manasseh's territory is described in boundary markers here. This is kind of what's going on. And Shechem is a city of refuge and a Levitical city. So later on, you know, does anybody know what a city of refuge is? If you did something and people were out to avenge, you know, their family or something, they were out to kill you, you could go to a city of refuge and kind of be protected. You know how, like in the old days, if a person would run into a Catholic church and take up, what's the word for it? Sanctuary. That's exactly the word. So that they couldn't be harmed. Well, that's how these sanctuary cities cities of refuge, they were sanctuary cities. You couldn't kill anybody. It's kind of like hanging on to the horns of the altar, you know. You couldn't be touched. And it was also a Levitical city, Shechem. So something. It's also a site of covenant renewal when Joshua dies. But these are things you're going to see later on in the book of Joshua. I'm foreshadowing these things. So if Steve comes to them and I'm not the one teaching it, I'm foreshadowing them, but I need to shut up before I, give a spoiler. Verse 9, then the boundary continued south to the Kanah Ravine. There were towns belonging to Ephraim lying among the towns of Manasseh, but the boundary of Manasseh was the northern side of the ravine and ended at the Mediterranean Sea. Now, we're going to look at the map a little bit on this, just because this is very hard when I'm just reading it off. You know, but I want to say this, the boundaries are kind of fluid in a way. I mean, they're not like these very clear demarcations when it comes to intra-Israelite, intra-Jewish people issues, because they're all on the same team, right? You know, so you'll see sometimes it creep up into another person's property. What I'm saying is, if you're looking for very straight lines, you won't find them in every instance. But it's just something to keep in mind. So on the south, the land belonged to Ephraim. On the north, to Manasseh. The territory of Manasseh reached the Mediterranean Sea and bordered Asher on the north and Issachar on the east. See, and with Issachar and Asher, Manasseh also had Beth Shan, Ebliam, and the people of Dor, Endor, Taanach, Megiddo, together with their surrounding settlements. The third in the list is Nephath. By the way, Endor, anybody know where, can you think of a science fiction movie where Endor appears? Star Wars, actually. the moon of Endor is where the Ewoks are found. But some of this, George Lucas lifts some names from the Bible. You'll notice that he also lifts some archetypes from the Bible. You've got the Cain and Abel story. You've got this whole good versus evil thing. He picks up on what we might call archetypes. But you remember there's a witch of Endor. Remember this whole thing with Saul, Samuel, that whole thing. And then Megiddo, you know, a lot of people point to this during end times, end time prophecy. Now, I'm ad-libbing a lot here today. You know, if I say something that seems baffling, stop me. Again, I'm a little medicated. Medicated. But let's move on here. Yet the Manassites were not able to occupy these towns, for the Canaanites were determined to live in that region. However, when the Israelites grew stronger, they subjected the Canaanites to forced labor, but did not drive them out completely. Here is another example about them failing to drive out the Canaanites. And the problem is this becomes a perennial thorn in their side, their failure to do it. And remember, we said that these Canaanites were composed of partly the offspring of the Nephilim, or the Bnei Elohim, which are the Nephilim, the Rephaites, and all these. And probably there are some that weren't contaminated with this, but so oftentimes they're dealt with indiscriminately. Anyway, let's move to verse 14. The people of Joseph. Now, who are the people of Joseph again? Can you remind me those two sons that were born in? Yeah. Said to Joshua, "Why have you given us only one allotment and one portion for an inheritance? We are a numerous people, and the Lord has blessed us abundantly." See, the people of Joseph considered themselves two tribes, not one. And remember just the chapter I had to quickly read, ad-lib-wise, chapter 16? They really are two, and there's, remember, this swapping of the hands for blessing. But sometimes, remember, there was the lot was rolled, one lot was rolled for them as if they were one, but they're not. They didn't consider themselves one. They considered themselves two, and they're like, what are you doing? I mean, you know, you've given us only one allotment. Something's wrong here. Well, Joshua's reply is this. If you are so numerous, you know, it's almost, I can almost hear him say, well, if you're so numerous, and if the hill country of Ephraim is too small for you, go up into the forest and clear the land for yourselves. They're in the land of the Perizzites and the Rephaites. There'd be giants in those lands, you know. But if there's so many of you, you know, Joshua's response is to the complaint. It's just challenging Joseph's descendants to clear the forest. Go out there and drive them out, clear the land, do all these things. Well, now, here you go. The people of Joseph replied, the hill country is not enough for us. of course not. And all the Canaanites who live in the plain have chariots fitted with iron, both those in Beth-shan and its settlements and those in the valley of Jezreel. Now, I hinted that these were not completely iron chariots. It would have been very tough to the kind of horses they had to pull those around. They'd be kind of unwieldy. But they were fitted with iron, maybe around the wheels and things and some things like that. But these guys are like, well, yeah, they're iron chariots, this whole thing. Where have we heard this before? Remember how we said what a great guy Caleb was? Joshua, we're well able to take the land. You know, they had the good report of the spies. And it just seems like over and over again, despite what God has promised, and the fact that they're getting all the land and all these things are happening, here they go back. Some trust in chariots, others in horses. We will trust in the name of the Lord our God. That should be the attitude of God's people. And yet here they, you know, they see some. So you've got a bad report. Bad report. It's like, you know, what percentage of the spies? You know, here they go again. But notice what Joshua's reply is. Kind of like it was when they spied out the land in the first place. But Joshua said to the tribes of Joseph, to Ephraim and Manasseh, you are numerous and very powerful. You know, you are numerous and very powerful. You will have not only one allotment, but the forested hill country as well. Clear it, and its farthest limits will be yours. Though the Canaanites have chariots fitted with iron, and though they are strong, you can drive them out. You can do it. You know, this is the idea. Joshua still has this frame of mind, just like in spying out the land. We are well able. Let us go in and possess the land. And he's having to remind Joseph's kids, his kids born in Egypt, the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh, you can do this. You can go in. You're well able to possess this land. But boy, you get tired of the back and forth, don't you? The good report and the bad report. Whose report are you going to believe? Remember that song, "We Shall Believe the Report of the Lord." You know, and anyway, this is the back and forth you see. Now, let's take a quick look at some of these, this land that's being talked about. Now, these are exactly the same maps, but the color is a little bit different on this first side. I'm going to focus on this first side. This gives a little bit more detail, maybe, but you can see East Manasseh and you can see West Manasseh here. You see these two areas and you see Ephraim here. So take a look at some of the borders. The border goes all the way north up to Mount Hermon. Remember how we said that was the bad place, you know, at least when I taught a couple weeks ago. And it extends all the way south down here. You'll see Simeon down here. You see Judah. You'll see some of these things bleed up into one another. Benjamin and Reuben and Gad, Naphtali, Asher, Zebulun, Dan. I mean, this is the allotment. This is basically how it's broken down. We'll look at it again here in a bit. But I want you to just kind of see as best you can. Now, notice how big of a chunk Manasseh has. I mean, they must be very numerous. And Ephraim. But they have a good, between these two sons of Joseph out of Egypt, they have a big chunk of the land, you know? So it's something to keep in mind. So we're going to jump on into chapter 18. Now, chapters 18 and through 19 describe the allotments of the tribes other than Judah, Ephraim, and Manasseh. Judah and Ephraim and Manasseh will be dealt with, while also summarizing all the other earlier inheritances. So chapter 18 is recounting Israelites meeting at Shiloh to divide the rest of the land. They're going to meet at Shiloh. Once that task is completed, lots are going to be cast for how to distribute this land. So they're going to have a come-to-Jesus moment, as we like to say, after the New Testament. They're going to have a meeting place in Shiloh, which is different from where they were before. Remember, they used to have camp set up in where? Do you remember? Gilgal. Remember? Chapter 5, chapter 9, chapter 10. Well, now they're in Shiloh. And they're setting up headquarters there, and they're going to divvy out this inheritance. So let's read a little bit about that. The whole assembly of the Israelites gathered at Shiloh and set up the tent of meeting there. This is important, that tent of meeting. You know, the country was brought under their control, but there were still seven Israelite tribes who had not yet received their inheritance. So Joshua said to the Israelites, "How long will you wait before you begin to take possession of the land that the Lord," meaning Yahweh, "the God of your ancestors has given you?" It's like, how long, people? You know, it's like, can you get with the program? Now, by the way, I've got to stop saying by the way. An aside, in addition to this, hey, in passing, let me mention, I'm trying to break certain habits. It's kind of like saying like and you just can't stop. It's like I'm drawn toward by the way. As an aside, let me mention this. This is probably a reference to the negligence in surveying the land. I mean, more than a judgment of military failure here. They're supposed to go out and survey the land, you know, look it all over, you know, and how long is it going to take you to get this done? He's basically calling on them to be cartographers. Appoint three men from each tribe. I will send them out to make a survey of the land and write a description of it according to the inheritance of each. Then they will return to me. It's kind of like, you know, you hear the story of Christopher Columbus or Vasco da Gama, all these people who have gone out. It always amazes me how, prior to satellites and things, how people could do a very good job of mapping out things and giving a description, whether they're sailing a ship along the shoreline and things like this. Cartographers were amazing. A cartographer is a person who both studies maps and creates maps. And essentially, Joshua is saying, you guys are cartographers. We're going to apportion this land, but you need to survey it. You need to have this a schematic drawn out. We need a map. And then we'll divvy it out, but that'll be done through the casting of lots. So get on with it. Let's get to moving, as they say. You are to divide the land into seven parts. Seven always seems, but of course there are seven left, right? Judah is to remain in its territory on the south, and the tribes of Joseph in their territory on the north. After you have written descriptions of the seven parts of the land, bring them here to me, and I will cast lots for you in the presence of the Lord our God. Now, remember, in the ancient Near East, division of a father's property among his heirs was customarily accomplished by the eldest choosing his parcel and then the rest being divided. So you see that Manasseh and Ephraim have already gotten their portion, and even Judah. But now what's left has to be decided. How do we decide? Once we get a description of the land, what do we do? Well, it's that Urim and Tumim, or the Urim and the Thummim, as we like to call it, anglicized. But the go on to verse 7. The Levites, however, do not get a portion among you, because the priestly service of the Lord is their inheritance. Why is it again that the Levites don't get anything? Yeah, the priests don't get anything. They're actually taken care of, right? They get to enjoy the fat, so to speak, and the sacrifice. So in some ways, it's kind of like this is some of your earliest descriptions of the full-time things. You know, it's where I grew up, full-time ministry. Where I grew up in the Midwest, pastors were almost always very holy. That is to say, their shoes have holes, their shirts have holes, their pants have holes. Everything is very holy. And the reason is Midwesterners tend to be, and I grew up with this kind of mindset, the pastor pastored full-time, but he also worked full-time, maybe in a factory or something like that. And there's something about the, let me just do a rabbit trail. There's so much out there now that's bad. You can find programs where people are bilking and milking people out of money, and it gives ministry a bad name. And that's unfortunate, because the counterfeit oftentimes discredits the genuine. But there are pastors, and I've watched many of them growing up. The last thing I wanted to do, when I went to college, I double majored pre-med, biological science, and Bible and theology. I said, because in my mind I thought, every pastor I knew was poor and broke. I'll be a doctor on top of it, and then I'll do both. You know, and then at a certain point, I felt like God said, no, you need to make a choice. The thing is, and maybe I could have been a medical missionary, who knows. I still like medicine and that kind of thing. But the ox is worthy of being fed. You shouldn't muzzle the ox if he's working. The worker for his hire. And I think early on you see this. Some people are called into full-time ministry, and the Levites were supported, so to speak, by the community of faith, that is the people. Of course, now this has gone into people wanting new jets and Rolls Royces and just bizarre things that, you know, I don't know what to say about this. But and I'm not saying God doesn't want to prosper his people in many ways, but what I think sometimes is there's been a shifting to a focus on materialism. Now, why did I run off onto this rabbit trail? Well, for the Levites, their full-time work was to serve God and the people. And consequently, they didn't get any land. You know, this is maybe why we have parsonages in a way. You know, we have a parsonage. The pastor, Greg, for example, lives behind the church. He doesn't own that house. The church owns that house. He and his family live there. But they serve the church, and there are some benefits or perks. So maybe that's just kind of where we get that. But
But I just a few minutes ago, sitting there looking at it, but you know, do you ever study if they want to
Yeah, you usually don't see that. Although, now let me just say this: I don't want to whitewash all the priests. Some of them got pretty nasty and bad at certain times, particularly through the time of the judges and things like that. But I digress. But what I'm saying is that there is a legitimate reason for people who are involved in ministry. The truth is, you can't give 100% of yourself to everything, because if you do, you break down. God teaches me this lesson quite well periodically. You can overextend yourself, and you just can't keep up. If I were working a second job, and I've done that, it can wear you out. So anyway, so bless all the pastors, Lord. That's what I'm saying, and I'm one of them. I know I'm biased. And Gad, Reuben, and the half tribe of Manasseh have already received their inheritance on the east side of the Jordan. Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave it to them. Okay, so these guys already had their stuff. What are we going to do with the rest of it? Well, after they surveyed the land, as the men started on their way to map out the land, Joshua instructed them. He said this: "Go and make a survey of the land and write a description of it. Then return to me, and I will cast lots for you here at Shiloh in the presence of the Lord." It's done in the presence of the Lord, the casting of the lots. It doesn't sound, it's almost like rolling dice, it sounds like. But the belief was, and God's Spirit would superintend this and ensure that they would get what they were supposed to get. So, verse 9, so the men left and went through the land. They wrote its description on a scroll, town by town, in seven parts, and returned to Joshua in the camp at Shiloh. Joshua then cast lots for them in Shiloh in the presence of the Lord, and there he distributed the land to the Israelites according to their tribal divisions. This is where it all went down. The first lot, this is the exciting part, guys. If you've been waiting with bated breath on the edge of your seat, here's where it gets exciting. The first lot came up for the tribe of Benjamin according to its clans. Their allotted territory lay between the tribes of Judah and Joseph. On the north side, their boundary began at the Jordan, past the northern slope of Jericho, and headed west into the hill country, coming out at the wilderness of Beth Avon. From there, it crossed to the south slope of Luz, that is Bethel, and went down to Adaroth Adar on the hill south of lower Beth Horon. From the hill facing Beth Horon on the south, and the boundary turned south along the western side and came out at Kiriath Baal, that is Kiriath Jearim, or Jearim, if we want to say, a town of the people of Judah. This was the western side. Aren't you glad there are four directions? The southern side began at the outskirts of Kiriath Jearim on the west, and the boundary came out at the spring of the waters of Nephtoah. The boundary went down to the foot of the hill facing the valley of Ben Hinnom, north of the valley of Rephaim. It continued down the Hinnom valley along the southern slope of the Jebusite city and so to En Rogel. It then curved north, went to En Shemesh, continued to Galilith, which faces the pass of Adumim, and ran down the stone of Bohan, son of Reuben. I'm going to have a tough time tonight. It continued to the northern slope of Beth Araba and on down into Araba. Let me just stop. This Galilith, the sequence of locations around Jerusalem kind of follows chapter 15, which I know Steve taught, right? Except that Galilith appears instead of Gilgal. Well, what does this word mean, Galilith? It's kind of like a Hebrew word that literally means districts. Gilgal and Galilith are kind of related, and they may be the same reference is what I'm getting at. And by the way, Beth Araba, this is associated with the site of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Remember the Qumran community? So these two, I'm just trying to give you some kind of something, milking something out of these verses that is describing it. Anyway, this is the description. It then went on to the northern slope of Beth Hogla and came out at the northern bay of the Dead Sea at the mouth of the Jordan in the south. This was the southern boundary. The Jordan formed the boundary on the eastern side. These were the boundaries that marked out the inheritance of the clans of Benjamin on all sides. The tribe of Benjamin, according to its clans, had the following towns: Jericho, Beth Hogla, Machaziz, Beth Araba, Zemarim, Bethel, Avim, Para, Ophrah, Kephar, Ammoni, Ophni, and Gibeah. 12 towns and their villages. I'm butchering some of these because I'm somewhere between a Hebraic pronunciation and anglicizing it, so I'm very muddled. Gibeon, Ramah, Be'eroth, Mizpah, Kephir, Mozah, Rechem, Irpeel, Taralal, Zalah, Ha'eleth, the Jebusite city, that is Jerusalem, Gibeah and Kiriath, 14 towns and their villages. This was the inheritance of Benjamin for his clans. Remember, I said at the beginning, this may seem boring to us, but this is God fulfilling his promise to Abraham in Genesis chapter 12. So let's take a look at this thing one more time. What I just said was, what you see here in a picture was described in those words, those many, many syllables. This is it. This is the allotment. And if you're interested, you know, I could always email you this. This could give you a few more details. The bottom line is they divvied out the land. after the primogenitors got theirs, then the rest of them got theirs, and it was based on casting lots. Now, here are a few things you can learn. You notice that I was so convinced this was chapters 17 and 18, but we did cover chapter 16. It was just a basic little thing on Manasseh and Ephraim. Yeah. The first thing is this, is God keeps his covenant. Again, this may seem boring in a way to rehearse this, but God has kept his promise to Abraham in Genesis chapter 12. It's a big deal. And he keeps his word. This is the God, whether it's through Abraham about this, or whether it's through Moses regarding these daughters who got an inheritance. God keeps his word. Remember, the daughters reminded him, the priest. Remember what Moses said? God is a God who keeps his word, who keeps his covenant. It's important.
Caleb said the same thing.
Yeah. Caleb said the same thing. Joshua's choices... God's choices may seem counterintuitive. Sometimes the way God chooses things, folks, isn't the way we would. He doesn't judge by the external, but he sees much deeper within us. And he's able to see things that, you know, how he can take a trickster like Jacob and turn him into Israel. How he would choose the Hebrew people who are enslaved and seemingly powerless, but make them a mighty nation out of them. How he picks Rahab, how he chooses, you see the switching over of the crossing over of the hands. He chooses Moses who stutters, or at least he's not eloquent in speech. And you see that with Ephraim and Manasseh, it's just not the way we would think. And I just want to pause there and say this. We need to be very careful about how we judge people. We never know who God might use. God will use people who will confound us oftentimes, and he will do things that we just don't understand. We just don't get with our natural minds sometimes. And then disobedience pays dividends, but not ones that you want to earn. I mean, not driving out the Canaanites. There, you plant corn, you get corn. You fail to do things. It's not just what we do, because obedience pays dividends as well. We tend to like to say that, boy, we reap what we sow, and sometimes we'll focus on the negative there. Boy, you got what you came, what was coming to you. But you know what? You can get good things too. If you grow up on a farm and you have weeds that crop up sometimes. The weeds, if there are five weeds and five plants that you've planted, that's a 50% problem. You know, but if you plant enough good seed, like in Indiana we have soybeans and corn, it stresses forever. If you get a few weeds, sometimes we planted some weeds, let's be honest. We've planted some bad seed. And when it comes up, if it's the only thing we've planted, it's going to be nasty. But if you plant good things, a lot of good things, maybe those bad seeds will come up. But compared to the harvest of the good, it will dilute the bad, and it can be a good thing. And I just want you to understand this law of reciprocity. We do reap what we sow. And disobedience, obedience is a fortress. Obey God, and you will be protected. He will, you know, that's the place of blessing. But disobedience will cause things too. So to know not good and not to do it, it's sin. That's what the scripture says. So not that I want to get you all caught up into works or something like that, but...
Mm-hmm. Into this day, they are working hard labor. Right? Yeah. I mean, watering and doing whatever they have to do. They kind of did the same thing with Canada. They allowed them to live and forced them to hard labor. But the other group did that, but the other group had no choice. I mean, they had no choice.
Well, the other, so yeah, so you had two groups, right? Anybody remember the name of the group that... The Jebusites, right. The Jebusites tricked God's people into making a vow, an oath. And so they ended up in indentured servitude, maybe worse. The Canaanites, on the other hand, had no such oath to protect them. And yet, sometimes they get, put into bondage. Sometimes nothing's done to them. And it takes a long time for them. By the way, you'll see these Jebusites all the way through Solomon, into the time of Solomon. The Canaanites, it takes a long time to drive them out, and sometimes not at all. The idea is obedience. And here's the thing. Now, by the way, I said by the way again. As an aside, just a thought. Sometimes you'll hear phrases like utterly destroy them and things like this. Sometimes that is hyperbolic. What I mean is the idea isn't necessarily to completely to destroy everybody, man, woman, chicken, child. It's more like get them out of the land, drive them out of the land. So it's not always meaning, absolute annihilation, but it does seem like annihilation of these descendants of the Nephilim and so on, that seemed like they had been set apart for that. So, all right, it's almost 8:30. I am very fatigued, I'll be honest with you. Thanks for your patience with me. I'm not going to keep you any longer. Any questions, thoughts, or comments? Yeah, hopefully this came through online. Friends, I am... My legs are literally a little shaky right now, so I'm going to go home and rest. And so appreciate that. Let me pray. Father, I thank you for your people, the ones that are online, the ones that are here, Lord, your people called by your name, the ones that you have given promises to, the ones that you have given commands to, Lord. Lord, we want to obey you. We want to possess everything that you have for us, God. And we can only do that through faith in Jesus Christ and faith that leads to obedience, God. So I pray that you help us to be a people that are obedient, that we are marked out as people who hear and obey your voice, Lord. And so I pray for each person here, Lord, that you strengthen us in faithfulness, you strengthen us in commitment, you strengthen us in hearing and discerning your voice and just being quick to either repent when you show us there's something that we've done wrong, or quick to do what you've shown us to do, God, so that we don't fail to please you. And Lord, I pray that you give us eyes and ears that are able to discern things that our natural senses wouldn't, Lord. For those people that seem like, who are they? They seem like the least, God, that we would recognize that, God, that you choose the foolish things of the world, this world, to confound the wise. God, help us to be mindful of this, God. So I bless your people. I thank you for what you've taught us tonight, God. Let everything that was of you bear fruit, Lord. Anything that wasn't of you just become null and void. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, friends. God bless you. Good night.